This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. Coming up, how the big banks manipulated the cost of nearly every transaction in the world, why the United States is complicit in the death of millions in Congo, and the last thing black radio listeners need is another syndication. But first, the Malcolm X grassroots movement has released a groundbreaking report on the killing of black people in America. The exhaustive study shows that police, security guards, and self-appointed civilians extrajudicially executed 130 black people between the beginning of this year and June 30th. That comes to one black death every 40 hours. Malcolm X grassroots movement activists Ajamu Baraka and Rosa Clemente spoke with Solomon Komasan on his radio program, Your World News. We begin with Ajamu Baraka.
This report clearly indicates that there is, in fact, a human rights crisis in the U.S. We see that because we are not getting a lot of coverage from the mainstream media, no real response from the administration, it just illustrates the cynical hypocrisy
that was
when it comes to the idea of human rights and the way it's used by this particular government and even this particular administration. So the implications are that we have a crisis, and that, as you said, if these were numbers coming from someplace else, they indicated that a particular population was being subjected to militarized violence from the state, resulting in the loss of life of this particular population. Many people around the world would agree that there was, in fact, a human rights issue within this country. But because this is happening in the center of the global empire of the U.S., and because of the power of the media corporations and the ability of the government to filter information, this information is not coming out. And it's important for it to come out for various reasons. One particular reason is about how people are directly experiencing these things in their communities. And they are. What this report does, though, is that it demonstrates that what people are experiencing in their communities that sometimes might seem unique to their particular area, besides one or two major cases that will come out, like a Sean Bell or Oscar Grant, what this case clearly indicates is that there is, in fact, a pattern of these abuses, a consistency of these abuses across the country. This is a systematic behavior that black communities across the country are being subjected to this kind of abuse. So we have a real crisis, and as human rights defenders, our responsibilities are to frame it as such and to try to break through the media barriers. Coming on shows like this where you have a constituency where you are committed to the truth and disseminating the truth and alternative information to try to get this information to the masses of our people.
Yeah, and I think the media piece is so critical, right? Because 4 years after having been part of an electoral political process as a candidate, it's gotten worse in terms of not only the mainstream media, but the so-called progressive media. You know, I mean, this is a story that should be in all the outlets that we support as progressive folks, right? And let me call myself, I'd rather call myself a radical or a total black left person, because these progressive media aren't picking up on the report either, right? And I think a lot of that speaks to how in the last 4 years with having a President Barack Obama, having this Democratic administration, a lot of people are lost. They're confused. They think that the only way to solve any problem is through, like, a federal administration, a president doing something, or even, you know, some politicians that are not even willing to look at this report. This report is over 35 pages long. It was not done by a nonprofit. We've had no resources to do this, which obviously speaks to the collective genius amongst all of us. But what it really says is, what are these institutions that call themselves progressive, label themselves as such, or come after us as black or Puerto Rican or Latino radical or left folks when they have a specific issue that they want to push. And then we put out a report, and the response is as negligible as the response from the mainstream media.
That was Rosa Clemente, former Green Party presidential candidate. She was preceded by Ajamu Baraka of the Malcolm X grassroots movement.
In Richmond, Virginia, the defenders of freedom, justice, and equality are marking their 10th anniversary. The nucleus of the activist organization came together in 2002 around specific instances of police and prison injustice. But it soon became clear that the entire system is rotten. Anna Edwards is a founding mother of the defenders.
You know, there were the more mainstream kind of peace and justice organizations that were going on, but their focus really did seem to be on those things like teen violence or violence in schools and being focused on anti-violence campaigns, anti-bullying campaigns and things like that. People were talking about things like recidivism rates, you know, why people were returning to prisons and not able to mainstream, but they weren't really very interested in challenging the system directly and saying it is capitalism that is one of the contributing factors to why we now have a prison industrial system that requires that we feed it, that we put bodies in there, and that once you get bodies in the prison system, they are at that point very much like we were in slavery. They are subject to the whim of the people who guard them and subject to the desires of the policymakers who want to see a prison system that has the ability to control a labor force in that way.
And so we see the defenders evolve from a group that grows up around specific criminal injustice circumstances. Mm-hmm. And 6 years later, you guys write a book in defense of Iran.
Yeah, that was kind of a no-brainer because if you think about it, and as we try very hard to make clear, one of our founding principles is the right of oppressed people to self-determination. It makes it very easy if you stop and think and not let yourself get caught up in rhetoric or simply believing rhetoric rather than, you know, tracking through the rhetoric to find out what the source is. It makes it very easy to analyze a given dynamic and recognize who is the perpetrator, who is the victim, and what are the circumstances that bring it about, and therefore how we know who we believe needs to be defended. And in the instance of the people of Iran, after all that we have been through in terms of the propaganda machine that was constructed in order to make it possible for the United States to invade Iraq and escalate the war in Afghanistan, we saw almost exactly, in some instances it felt like it was almost verbatim, the kind of propaganda that was then implemented against Iran in order to foment public mainstream support, or even to some extent, just as bad, public silence on the way we were being guided towards justifying an attack on Iran. And in fact, the war on Iran has already begun, and that's something that is outlined in that book, In Defense of Iran, as well.
So the domestic victims of the lies of the state should recognize the foreign victims of the lies of the same state.
Absolutely. We are absolutely committed to the idea that the war at home and the war abroad are inextricably linked. And, you know, if you're talking about the drone wars on civilians, the drone attacks on civilians outside of the United States, then you are also talking about the attacks on our communities by refusing to educate, refusing to have jobs, refusing to ameliorate or cease and desist the growing police abuse on our communities. It's the same. It's coming from the same place. It's coming from the same system. And so when we stand up in defense of the people of Iran, we also stand up in defense of the people of Palestine. We stand up in defense of the people in Africa, in the different struggles that's in the Sudan, in the Congo, in Nigeria against the oil companies, in Mali against what is almost a gang rape of a nation. It's imperative that we see the connection between that and the loss of funding and the loss of attention, the loss of prioritizing focus on the wars at home, on our very communities, on our very children.
From your beginning in 2002, how long was it before you formed your newspaper?
The newspaper was launched in February of 2005. And the radio program, Defenders Live, was launched actually in January of that year, so both at the same time. And initially, it was an opportunity to take the struggle to reclaim Richmond's African burial ground to a statewide level and to a national level. And that first issue of the newspaper, which was then called the Richmond Defender, was dedicated to revealing the history of the burial ground itself as an historically significant site, but also to lay out the history of community struggle to make people aware of its existence, and then finally the beginnings of the struggle to really reclaim it from being a parking lot that was privately owned at that time, but then was eventually purchased by Virginia Commonwealth University.
And what are the defenders doing for their birthday?
Well, we seem to be very busy still working. It's kind of hard to stop and have a party. We are working right now. We are working on this anniversary issue of the Virginia Defender newspaper. And we will be looking at making sure that the work that we leave behind, as well as the work going forward, is very clear, again, in the grounding and the principle of the right of oppressed people to self-determination and the need and the importance of building mass, multi-issue, multi-racial movement for fighting for fundamental social, political, and economic change.
Anna Edwards of the Defenders of Freedom, Justice, and Equality in Richmond, Virginia.
It may come as no surprise that the world's biggest banks have been manipulating the benchmark interest rates on which most of the world's finances are based. The benchmark is called LIBOR. Dr. Richard Wolff, Professor Emeritus of Economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, explains what the scandal is all about.
So LIBOR basically stands for London Interbank Offered Rate. That fancy set of words with the abbreviation LIBOR, LIBOR, refers to the interest rate charged by 16 of the world's biggest banks when they lend each other money, typically overnight, because it's a kind of basic rate of interest when you don't have much worry about who you're lending to, because it's such a short time, and because there's such a monster bank you're lending to, that it's virtually riskless 99% of the time. And so what happens is that's your benchmark of what you can basically get money for, and then you adjust it depending on how much riskier any particular borrower is than these virtually riskless monster banks located in London. And so what happened over the years was, as more and more of the global economy became dependent on credit, as Americans, for example, since the 70s, came to use credit cards literally to go into a store and buy a can of soda, and everybody was borrowing for their house, for their car, for their students' education, and so on, and corporations borrowed more and more, and governments borrowed more and more, the interest rates became a much more dominant part of the global economy. And so everybody was lending and borrowing, and there needed to be some sort of standardization of what was being charged by whom, depending on the length of time of the loan and the riskiness. And so to make a long story short, starting around the mid-80s, a group of bankers, together with the banking authorities in Great Britain, which was traditionally for the last 150 years the kind of financial center of the world economy, the only competitor could have been New York, and because London had it historically, it happened there. So these 16 banks, together with the British Banking Association and the Bank of England, which is the English equivalent of the Federal Reserve here, got together and had an arrangement. And it went like this. On a regular basis, the British Banking Association and the Bank of England would literally telephone the key executives of the 16 biggest banks in the world, ask them what they were charging one another for short-term loans, take an average of most of those responses, and announce that as the going rate, that average, as the going rate of interest for the least risky loans. And so a bank in Topeka, Kansas, that was lending to local people for their credit cards would tell them, okay, we're going to charge you LIBOR plus two, or LIBOR plus 3. In other words, to make our profit, we have to borrow money at the basically LIBOR rate, and we lend it to you at a slightly higher rate. We pick up the difference, and that's the profit of the bank or lender who engages in this. And everybody then used that as a benchmark, and it became a custom to proceed in that way. Very few people knew exactly how this was done. There was no oversight about what these 16 banks exactly told the authorities in England that they then used for the average calculation of the LIBOR. And what has happened now is that because of the serious crisis that the world is in since 2007, it has now emerged, somebody spilled the beans, that these 16 bank executives, or at least a portion of them, it'll take time to figure out how many were in on this, were cooking the books. That is, they were saying things when reporting the interest rates that were not accurate. I'm being polite here. They manipulated the rate to be something other than it actually was because they stood to gain for their banks from doing that. And it's clear now that they did it. One monster bank, Barclays Bank of Great Britain, one of the biggest banks in that country and indeed in the world, has not only admitted doing it, but has admitted it to the extent of paying now over $450 million in penalties and fines for this illegal behavior to regulatory authorities both in Britain and in the United States. And there's an enormous investigation going on as to what other banks that were in on this not only reported interest rates, but may have done something like Barclays did, in which case they too will be subject to prosecutions, they too will be subject to fines, and we're only at the beginning of a process because all around the world, other banks, other lenders, in fact, all borrowers who have a case that they ended up paying a higher interest than they might otherwise have had to pay because these banks manipulated a rate, are going to be filing legal suits against these banks to recover the damages they claim they suffered from this procedure. It had been the understanding that this rate-setting mechanism was somehow objective, neutral, fair, not arbitrary, and beyond self-serving. What we now know is, once again, that the biggest bankers in the world are not above using their positions to manipulate the markets in which they deal every day to gain advantage for themselves and their banks, no matter what the cost to people around the world. Last point. Every one of us is affected by this. First of all, if you have a car loan, a credit card loan, a student loan, or a mortgage loan, the interest rate you're paying and the way it goes up and down if it's variable is dependent on LIBOR and therefore dependent on what those 16 banks, including the now admitted fraudulent behavior of Barclays, what they did. But even if you don't have a loan outstanding, remember that every store that you go into is a store run by a company that had to borrow money all the time as a normal part of its business. And you can be very sure that if that store had to pay interest rates higher than they otherwise would have, that would show up in higher prices for you to pay. So whether you borrow or not, if you're alive and if you spend money, you're affected in Lord knows how many ways by yet another huge corporation sacrificing your interests to improve its own. And it is clear to me that because of the economic crisis of the last 5 years, since we're still now going through it in year five, because of that crisis, these big banks were afraid for their survival. We should remember that Barclays, the one that has admitted to it all, is the bank to which the Federal Reserve Bank of New York sold the bulk of the assets of Lehman Brothers when that corporation collapsed in 2008. These are all people who know each other. These are all people who knew that their respective banks were in deep trouble. And it wouldn't have been all that hard to think that when your survival is at stake, You might bend every rule, adjust every report, manipulate wherever you could to get through these hard times. What we have to understand, though, is if you have banks of this enormous magnitude wielding that much power out of public responsibility, you really can't be surprised if it ends up that the luck of our situation gives us a glimpse, and that's all it is, into one kind of manipulation. A reasonable person couldn't possibly respond to this other than by wondering how many other aspects of our financial lives in a hard time are being manipulated by top executives in such situations.
And since this reaches into all of finance, all of the over the world, everybody's pockets, it seems absolutely impossible that there could be adequate compensation from these banks to those who have been harmed.
That's right. You'd have to go through an unbelievable calculation trying to figure out all the first-level results, secondary-level results. I mean, to give you an example, if an interest rate was higher or lower than it ought to have been, then all the people affected by that, every bank around the world, every hedge fund that engages in what are called derivatives, investments that depend on the ups and downs of interest rates, every step that they took, they can show, was dependent on the LIBOR rate they were informed about. And if they then had losses along the way, they will claim those losses were because the LIBOR was manipulated. You would then have to have, you know, months of investigation to verify whether that was true or not, what portion of their losses could reasonably be attributed. And when you multiply that by all the lenders and borrowers around the world, yes, you're absolutely right. Literally everybody would have a case. You'd have to have class action suits around the world. Banks, by the way, the big banks are now, in fact, worried that at least some of the people who were directly hurt are going to be filing lawsuits against them. Let me give you one example that's very dramatic here in the United States. In the 90s and in the early decade of this century, many cities and towns across America were approached by big banks in New York, Morgan Stanley, J.P. Morgan Chase, Citibank, and so on, and told that they could improve their finances if they got involved in these complicated new financial instruments, particularly credit default swaps, interest swaps, and so on. Many of the cities did that, believing these bankers when they explained how that would work. When that went bad, in part because of the economic crisis, but now it turns out also in part because of manipulations of the LIBOR rate, which was crucial to many of these investments, these cities and towns, instead of getting a better situation in their finances, found themselves suddenly having to pay out huge amounts of unexpected money. And if you look at the recent bankruptcies of major American cities, Scranton, PA, San Bernardino, California yesterday, Stockton, California over the last few months, you'll see that in a number of those cities that are laying off public employees and cutting back basic services, including, you know, cops and fire and everything else, one of the things that's happening to cause the extra trouble of many of these cities are, once again, these new financial instruments, partly dependent on the LIBOR rate out of London, and so the mess of the current capitalist system simply deepens and permeates more and more of our lives, giving us yet another lesson in an economic system that has broken down, at least for the vast majority, who aren't in a position to manipulate interest rates.
And since these losses, these harms are astronomical, and since all of these banks have been deemed too big to fail, then they must be protected, and whatever compensation there will have to come from the social purse.
Absolutely, and you can already see the advanced sign of this. Barclays Bank, a bank that deals in hundreds of billions, indeed trillions of dollars in any year, agreed to pay $450 million. Now, that's not pocket change. That's a lot of money. But for a bank that deals in hundreds of billions and trillions, $540 million is, as one of the newly revealed emails among the executives said, a, quote, bump in the road. So they hoped, clearly, that by paying $450 million in fines, roughly, that they would then put this story behind them. And that would be a relatively small price to pay. All the other banks could hopefully get away with not being investigated. Unfortunately, that hope of theirs has now been dashed as at least a few political forces were active in London, particularly the opposition Labour Party, which saw a political advantage here and pursued this, so that now we've had not only the fine paid, but the two top executives of Barclays have resigned their jobs, Robert Diamond and a man named Agius, and the investigations into other major banks that are part of this group, which, by the way, includes Citibank and Goldman Sachs, that they're not far behind in having scrutiny applied to them. And now we'll watch this spectacle, and I'm afraid you're probably right, that there'll be a lot of hand-wringing and finger-pointing and mutual blaming. You could see it already in London last week between the banks blaming the government for not regulating and the government blaming the companies for manipulating in an evasive way that couldn't be regulated. We'll never know the answer to that, and what's likely to happen is we'll have some more fines, we'll have some more headlines. And then, since no one dares to question the basic system, these people will be gone, new individuals will take their place, but the system having not changed, the new individuals will in all likelihood resume one or another form of what the old individuals did.
And we know from the Barclays situation that the bankers were particularly interested in how these small changes in LIBOR would affect derivatives. And derivatives now are nominally valued worldwide, some people believe, at $1,000 trillion, phantasmagorical amounts of
money. Numbers that are there. At least everyone agrees, although there's disputes about the exact amount, everybody agrees that there are hundreds of trillions of dollars worth of financial contracts, financial instruments out there in the world whose value is affected by whether LIBOR is up a slight amount more or down a slight amount more. And, you know, the problem clearly was that the banks who gave the report as to what it is they were actually charging had a vested interest, themselves owned or acted on behalf of their clients who owned the instruments affected by what they reported. Now, that's a classic example of conflict of interest. You should not be in a position of announcing a public number if at the same time you are investing in securities that depend on that number, because obviously you're then going to be tempted to report a number, whether it's true or not, that advances your financial interests. It's crystal clear from what Barclay admitted to that that's what was going on, that these banks were not reporting accurately, were giving either too high or too low, depending on what their interest was, because it advantaged them and their holdings and their speculations. And if that damaged others around the economy, well, it was a crisis, and it's every man or woman for themselves. And the big banks were using their power to protect themselves. And the rest of us can live through it or not. It's not their concern. That's the way the system works.
And because of the scope of LIBOR-impacted activity, I guess this might be the greatest and deepest fraud of all time.
Well, in terms of its reach, and because we'll never know really how much losses could reasonably be attributed, because it's literally an impossible calculation to make, but your basic supposition here is correct, that the sheer scope, you know, we have now a globalized economy. We have an economy in which every part is hooked in large part by credit, by lending, to every other part. And so if something goes wrong in a major financial center, and London is arguably the major financial center, the only competitor would be New York, but if something goes wrong in New York or London, it's going to impact every corner of the global economy, and therefore, in the sense of its social impact, yes, it's the biggest scandal that we've ever had. Will it be the most costly? Not only is there no way for me to predict that, there'll be never any way to kind of really sort all that out. What we'll know is that these banks were able and willing, under the circumstances they were in, to improve their own balance sheets, their own bank's situation, by misreporting in a way that is unethical, dishonest, and illegal, what they were supposed to be doing in a system that had worked for 25 years, or let me take that back. We don't know whether this is the first time, whether it was only the crisis that did it. We don't know whether they didn't do this earlier. I suspect and I hope that there will be at least some investigations to see how long this has been going on. But as I said before, Glenn, not the least question that should emerge here is that there are many other situations where handfuls of major executives in the financial industry, but outside of it too, sit down with their so-called regulatory counterparts in a government of the United States or other countries, working out deals that will affect all of us in ways that can involve and often do very similar activities. And one has to wonder whether the behavior of Mr. Diamond at the head of Barclays is going to turn out to be all that unusual, all that atypical. Frankly, I think the burden of proof lies on people who think that, whereas the rest of us who suspect that this is very widespread and long in existence have it closer to the truth.
That was Dr. Richard Wolff.
Black syndicated talk show host Michael Basden has been asking his listeners to help him get a slot on New York's WBLS-FM, the city's last remaining black-oriented powerhouse radio station. But veteran broadcaster Paul Porter, publisher of the influential newsletter Industry Ears, says that what blacks in New York and everywhere else in the nation really need is quality, locally produced programming.
You know, I find it amazing in this day and age and with technology and a city as large as New York but has no local information or news except something that's excerpts during a morning show or, you know, a Sunday night show. And it shows you just where locally licensed radio stations have been going over the past 20 years. And that's towards syndication when it comes to black radio. And black radio in general has taken the lump of syndication. While we celebrate Tom Joyner and Steve Harvey and Michael Basden, they're exactly what's wrong with our radio and our insight and our information. We've been siphoned into three or four voices nationally, broadcasting to local audiences, and stations are licensed to serve local communities, and they don't touch on local issues. They don't deliver local news. The best they can do is some local traffic.
In fact, you've written that black adults are 75 times more likely to hear syndicated radio than white adults.
When you go into large markets or basic radio markets, there's an average of 40 to 60 stations in a market. But when you go for people of color, there's an average of one or two stations that play music at least formatted to their taste. And large markets all have a couple of syndicated shows on them. It's not one. You know, a large market like Washington, D.C. has syndication on every one of the urban stations there, including the gospel. So it's way out of hand. It happens in white talk radio, of course, but white formatted music stations, it doesn't happen. We celebrate it, but we shouldn't. We should be looking at it closely and trying to understand why this happens to people of color.
And that's very interesting because Washington is a market that has a relatively speaking large number of black-oriented outlets, but few local black voices because all these stations are given over to syndication.
Yeah, well, you know, the excuse is because they don't bill as much. The excuse is that they can book more star guests and star talent. Well, my excuse is how come it doesn't happen on the other ends? How come out of the 50 stations in the market, the white stations don't have that same problem in terms of billing? You know, everybody doesn't have the high numbers. These stations, they garner a large share, market share all the time. Urban radio stations do well. They just don't bill well. So maybe they should be fighting for billing. As a matter of fact, when you said black orientated, there's a coalition that was started by BET about 2 weeks ago of black orientated stations led by Deborah Lee fighting to get more ad dollars. You know, Radio 1's the only black owned in there, but everybody else is Clear Channel Communications. So there's a cry from broadcasters that they're not getting enough money. But whenever they get money, they find a new show to simulcast. So they'll syndicate like a Key Sweat and so on and so forth. And we always get shortchanged in terms of content, music, news, and information.
Yes, that is the point. They're always crying that they can't provide local programming or quality programming because the advertisers aren't paying them, but they have no history of using their windfalls, whenever they get them, to provide the local and quality programming that they claim they want to air.
Well, they never reinvest the dollars into better products or better shows or the normal things that you would expect them to do. So they want it, but they don't want to put the work in.
You know, we talk a lot about black radio listenerships being so loyal. The owners take that loyal listenership for granted.
Look, people of color like looking at themselves, if it's television or radio, things that seem black or appear black, they support. You know, I often go to the example years ago, Cosby Show was number one in 1986 on NBC with a black family. And years later, 20 years later, The Flavor of Love was the number one show with Flavor Flav playing the role as a modern day pimp on VH1. And it shows you how we've went backwards in terms of content. It really has. Things are not getting better, but it's getting worse.
I remember when the NAACP effectively put Amos and Andy off the air, off of television. And yet much of the buffoonery that we saw later in the 70s and continue to see is far more offensive than Amos and Andy.
Oh yeah. Well, you're preaching to the choir here. It's amazing some of the shows that consistently happen. You know, I often talk about WLBT television down in Mississippi years ago, finally getting taken off due to protests by the FCC and how they were misconstruing the civil rights actions, and they took that station's license. But you can look at Fox News, you can look at programs, you can look at radio stations and say it's amazing. Personally, I would be into the protest, slam, take it back, but we have to do a better job fighting to get some of the policy and building our own stuff to really make a difference here.
Out there in the darkness that black radio, black-oriented radio has become, you found a couple of shining lights. One's in Muskegon, Michigan.
There's something called LPFM, low-power FM, started a little bit over 10 years ago. And there's a brother, Paul Billings, was one of the first in the country to get a low-power FM, which is basically a non-profit low-power signal radio station. His station, 103.7 The Beat, you can get it at 103.7thebeat.com. They've done great. They're top four in their market with a low-power signal. He'll play speeches from Malcolm X in the background. He'll do black radio how it was done in the 60s and 70s, and they win in their market. You know, they don't play the misogyny, the beat-down gangster rap on their shows. They have a young adult show. They have a gospel show. They have news and information, a small staff. But, you know, that station proves to me that if you deliver good content, you can win, too. That's always the excuse for radio execs. You know, there's something on raprehab.com with Alfred Liggins basically explaining that this is what the people want. But if that's all you give the people, that you can't really tell what they want. You don't research or even experiment in giving us any balance anymore, so...
Well, those of us who come from radio know that if you play a dog record enough times, it will sell.
That's the case. Repetition has changed the game. Back in the 70s, when I started on urban radio, early 80s, a top 10 song would get played once every 4 or 5 hours. I was just looking at numbers, which I do. Hot 97 in New York played Kanye West Mercy 120 times in a 7-day period, which equals about every 75 minutes. And with commercials, that's basically every 60 minutes, once an hour. So there's really no choice in the system. They drill records into your head. And sooner or later, you like them or you don't like them. And that's the big problem with variety, too. Variety's been taken out of the mix.
Something close to 80% of black households still listen to black-oriented radio.
Oh, yeah, that's what I'm saying. We're the first to lose them and the information, and we're the most to listen to, and they do the least amount of giving information and things to our audience. Public service, you know, when the FCC pulled that off the books in the late 90s, there's nothing that holds stations accountable to the markets that they serve. And even in terms of news and information. So we got to get it together, and people have to understand that it's still important. And until something else comes and kills it, why not have yours? And Low Power FM, LPFM, they're granting a bunch of new licenses next year. In major markets, I think it's over 400 signals. You can get a Low Power FM station, which goes up to 250 watts, have it on air, go through the whole process for about $12,000 to $15,000. I'm in for two licenses in my area of Florida now, that I'm going to get one just because they're that cheap to have and maintain. You can run out of your house and get some good content out there. And the brother Paul Billings at WUVS in Muskegon, we're doing seminars and helping people, because he did all the paperwork on his own. It's not all super lawyer-driven. It's hard, but they make it hard, but it's worth it in the long run.
In Muskegon, that's 100 watts. How big a broadcast radius is that?
He gets around 40 miles, and he petitioned the FCC earlier this year, and they're letting him and all the new LPFMs go up to 250 watts.
Paul Porter of the Industry Ears newsletter.
The United Nations has released yet another report showing Rwanda continues to destabilize the neighboring Congo, where 6 million people have died since the mid-90s. Glenn Ford says the U.S. is also complicit in the genocide in Congo, part of its policy to create chaos in Africa.
The United Nations has finally released a report detailing Rwanda's latest destabilization of the neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo. As usual, the delay was caused by the United States, which routinely blocks criticism of its military and political client state, Rwanda, which has since 1996 been deeply complicit in the death of 6 million Congolese. The United States is, therefore, also liable for the genocide in Congo, the largest mass killing since World War II. Apologists for U.S. policy in Central Africa are fond of using the word strategic. The United States, they say, arms and protects Rwanda because America has strategic business and defense interests in the Congo's vast mineral deposits. The infinitely corrupt Congolese strongman Mobutu Sese Seko used to be Washington's attack dog in Africa. But in the mid-90s, the Americans opted to back an invasion of eastern Congo by the Tutsi minority regimes in Rwanda and Burundi, and the other U.S. client state in the region, Uganda. Washington chose to put its strategic interests in the hands of a small but highly militarized people, the Tutsi, rather than help the Congolese government maintain control over its own territory. Why would the United States choose such allies to protect its so-called strategic interests? On the face of it, this would seem like a formula for endless war in the region. Even before the mass killing of Tutsis in 1994, they never comprised more than 15% of the population in Rwanda or in Burundi, where Hutu people make up the vast majority. Having lorded it over the Hutus during and prior to the arrival of European colonialism, and having massacred many Hutu in both nations after independence, the Tutsis are not loved by their fellow countrymen. They have since become a primary source of destabilization and genocide in Congo. So the question is, why does the United States place its strategic interests in the hands of the elite of a warlike minority in the heart of Central Africa? Why would Washington invest millions in minority-ruled governments of tiny countries like Rwanda and Burundi, which can only be sources of permanent instability in the region? Don't the Americans understand that support for tiny, aggressive elites guarantees continued chaos? The answer is, yes, they do understand. Since independence, U.S. policy in Africa has almost always been to choose chaos in those places where it cannot rule directly. And chaos brings genocide. The U.S. reasons that, at any given moment, chaos contains many options, an infinity of possibilities for superpower action, whereas stable regimes with broad popular support provide less room for the foreigner to maneuver, less possibilities for a quick change of policy or regime. Which is one reason that China looks good to Africa and to much of the rest of the former colonized world. The Chinese do not foment coups or encourage whole regions to become saturated in arms. They just want to do business in a stable environment. That's why China has surpassed the U.S. as Africa's trading partner, and why U.S. imperialism will ultimately be defeated. Because nobody wants someone around who spreads chaos and mass death everywhere he goes.
The women in Sierra Leone, West Africa, may stand a better chance of surviving their pregnancies because of a collaboration with black people across the Atlantic Ocean. Aisha Fields of the Uhuru Movement explains.
The All African People's Development and Empowerment Project, or APDEP for short, is an African-led development organization that organizes African people, black people, all around the world who have various kinds of skills, nurses, doctors, engineers, teachers, and folks who may or may not have those kind of technical skills, but who want to be involved in development work in Africa and in African communities around the world. And so we take it upon ourselves as African people to use APDEP as our vehicle for really trying to improve the conditions that have been imposed on our people wherever we are.
And now you have this project, this very promising project in Sierra Leone. Why did you choose Sierra Leone to set up a nursing school?
Well, Sierra Leone is the home of one of our sister organizations. APDEP is a part of the Uhuru Movement, and we have been establishing organizations, various other aspects of the Uhuru Movement in Sierra Leone since about 2005. And so it was just kind of a natural fit for APDEP to begin initiating projects in Sierra Leone because of the organizational kind of work that had been happening there since about that time. And Sierra Leone is a place that in many ways has some of the worst conditions, not only for African people, but for any human being anywhere in terms of its infant maternal mortality rates, its life expectancy, in terms of people's access to health care and basic kind of necessities of life. So it just kind of made sense that we began to do work in Africa in Sierra Leone first.
I see that one out of every eight women die in childbirth in Sierra Leone.
When you look at not only Sierra Leone, but any place in Africa, you find a situation where you have a real shortage of any kind of medical personnel, nurses, doctors, other medical professionals, real shortage of decent medical facilities. You know, you have difficulties with just getting clean water, having access to enough food in the day, and the conditions for our folks are such that when sisters get pregnant, they usually, if they get an opportunity to see a doctor at all, they usually are in such a state of poor health before they get pregnant that pregnancy is really almost like a complication, because what winds up happening in Sierra Leone and in other places is that women die, generally speaking, because of issues like bleeding out, because they have such low iron levels and have such a poor kind of access to nutrition during their pregnancy. And because there's such a shortage of medical personnel and medical facilities, that when there are complications in pregnancy, generally speaking, the sisters have nowhere to turn. And while we do have women who are traditional birth attendants, who are basically like community midwives who attempt to address the question of helping women in childbirth, oftentimes they're not able, they're not trained to deal with complications. So it is really not uncommon, not only for this 1 in 8 situation to happen in general, but in many of the communities we worked in, sometimes it looks more like 1 in 5 women who are dying in childbirth.
So this, your first graduating class, which consists of 45 nurses, this is a substantial number for such an underserved community as in Sierra Leone.
Yes, it is. I mean, I think that one of the things that is really unique about APDEP is that we're calling on African people to use the skills that we have to make an immediate difference in the lives of our people. And, you know, oftentimes I think it's the perception that Africa does not have skilled people, that Africa does not have folks who can be available to, you know, address the conditions in Africa that we're faced with. But the reality is that we have lots of skilled people, but we don't have opportunities oftentimes for our people to use that skill to make a difference. So, for example, in Sierra Leone, because there's such a shortage of nursing schools and other medical institutions, we got folks who would want to become nurses, and we've got folks who even are nurses who can't practice. They don't have hospitals and clinics to practice or enough institutions to actually teach if that's the way they want to make their contribution. And so it wasn't really something that we were really thinking wasn't going to be something that attracted lots of people, because folks want to go into the medical field. They want to be able to find a way to help contribute to improving the health of our people there in Sierra Leone. And so we weren't really that surprised at the numbers. And I think that we're on the path to really having a really big impact in terms of producing nurses in the country.
But another number is money, and you need some.
Yes, we do. We need some money. Our nursing school is at a point now where we have to get accreditation. And the accreditation process has been something that we've been involved in for some time now. And, you know, it has included site visits to our school and to the clinics that are associated with our school, and looking into the quality of the education that our students are receiving, and making sure that we had certain kinds of nurses and teachers available for our students. And we've come to a place now where the final requirement is that we pay the accreditation fee, which is $5,000 by July the 25th. And so we've been pushing really hard over the last couple weeks to make that, because we have got to keep the doors open to this nursing school. And we really just kind of short notice were told from the nurses board there that we've got to get this fee in by then. So we're really calling on people to contribute to this effort, that we can raise this $5,000 by July the 25th.
APDEP says it wants to train a core of African internationalist nurses who can be deployed any place in the world. That sounds like a Cuba-scale mission.
Well, I think that Cuba has the right idea, that they have created a situation where there are so many nurses and doctors and other medical people in their country that not only can they provide a high standard of care for their own people right there in Cuba, but that they can deploy nurses and doctors throughout the world where there's a need. And I think that is where we're headed. I think that not only are we looking at Cuba as a model, but we're looking at what Marcus Garvey was able to accomplish in his UNIA in the early part of the 20th century, where, you know, he developed the Black Cross nurses as an auxiliary of the UNIA. And there were sisters and some brothers who came together in that formation and used their skills to try to address the health issues that African people were confronted with in places like the U.S. and Belize. And so we're taking our cues from Marcus Garvey and, like you rightly mentioned, Cuba, to be able to really develop a core of nurses who can go anywhere in the African world to address the questions of health for our people. And I think it's on time, because we have so many examples around the world where there have been disasters and there have been just outbreaks where our people have been at the mercy of others and it hasn't ever turned out well for us. And I think it's high time that African people come together and take responsibility for our own health, take responsibility for our people wherever we may be located, and make sure that we can be right on time to help when there's a need.
And would the same principle apply to other skills and professions, internationalist engineers?
Absolutely, absolutely. In fact, one of the things that we're calling on to be established is the AFDEP Corps of Engineers, Scientists, and Healthcare Workers. And this core would be a group of people who have all kinds of technical expertise who could be called on to not only participate in the projects that we've established in Sierra Leone and in the U.S. and where we'd like to establish, but that could be called on, again, much like the nurses, anywhere to address situations of disaster and need for African people. So that's the vision. That's where we're headed. In fact, we're going to be having a conference in October 13th and 14th in Washington, D.C., our third annual AFDEP conference. And in that conference, we'll be putting that call out to establish that, and we're hoping that people can join us for that as well.
And that's it for this week's Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Giselle Hernandez.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.